storage is the hardest problem in computing. And that's why we have the Red Rocks make sense. Because as soon as you store your data, it starts decaying, right? Because storage is essentially anti-entropic. And entropy is what the universe wants to do. So, you know, that's why we have to keep putting energy into storage, because it wants to disorganize itself. That's entropy. And so in order to maintain it in an organized form, we have to keep putting energy into it. And I think that's going to become more and more obvious as, you know, processors get faster and better and more efficient, and networks do the same. You know, really, storage is the problem. And searching storage, I think, is probably the problem of the 21st century. So that's a little bit about me. I worked at DEC, Sun, Quantum, Bull, yada, yada. A startup that's, amazingly enough, still in business. And now I moved to Sedona three years ago, and so now I'm just kind of a guy, you know, up in the Red Rocks. And so slide three, disclosure, companies do hire me to help them do things, companies hire me. When I started, I was hoping to figure out a way to get end users to hire me so that I could be more independent of companies. But what I've gradually come to realize is that I'm just a pretty independent guy, and I'm not easily buffaloed, because I've been in the marketing business for 25 years, and I know how to buffalo people, and I know when it's being done to me, and I don't like it. So I'm pretty independent. I do sometimes buy or receive stock from companies. I also sell stock sometimes, but that's probably not as important. But most of my money comes from marketing consulting. So I do things called video white papers, regular white papers. I do competitive analysis and strategic planning, writing, messaging, new media consulting. Because I'll tell you, building a blog from zero to, as near as I can tell, Storage Mojo is the most read storage blog. Except for my other blog, Storage Bits, which has the ZDNet platform and does better. So when I talk about a company that I have a relationship with, I'll mention that, or stock, I'll mention that. But you'll notice I don't do a lot of mentioning of companies, so it's not a big problem. And you can, you know, so what does that mean to you? Whatever you'd like it to mean. But I like to be upfront and, you know, be as transparent as possible. Okay, Data Center Mojo, slide four. So here's the agenda: 2.5-inch enterprise drives, high-end SSDs, guaranteed uptime. I think that's a real sleeper. 10 giggy and cloud storage. So we're starting from the little and going to the very big. Okay. Before I get started, disruptive technology, slide five. To me, it was fascinating that Christensen, Clayton Christensen, who wrote The Innovator's Dilemma, he called technology that changes industries disruptive. And yet, when you actually looked at the technologies that he talked about, there was really very little, especially in the disk drive industry. And that book, if you haven't read that book, highly recommended for all storage geeks, because it's based on Jim Porter of Disk Trends, excellent information that he gathered doing, 30 years as the gold standard in storage market research. Jim generously shared that with Clayton, and Clayton built a best-selling book out of it. But if you really look at it, the disruptive technology that Clayton talks about in the storage world is just the fact that people made disk drives smaller. What's so technical about that? I mean, you go from, you know, the first disk drives were 24-inch. Somebody actually made a 36-inch disk drive. I was like, oh, my God. It kind of looks like a merry-go-round or something. But so they went from 24-inch to whatever, 18-inch, and then, there was some 14-inch, and 9-inch, and 8-inch, 5.25, 3.5, 2.5, and, anyway. And to me, what this, you know, what probably he should have called it is that disruptive economics. And clearly in the disk drive business, changing the size of a disk has been historically disruptive. So, you know, it's really about disruptive economics rather than disruptive technologies. But I use technologies in my title, so I guess I'm just as guilty as Clayton Christensen. Slide six, 2.5-inch disks. I think this is really important because you can have 5 to 6 actuators in the space of a single actuator today. It's 1/3 to 1/4 the power per spindle, and of course, so if you do the math, you figure out, oh, it's actually more power for 5 or 6 drives than it is for one 3.5-inch drive. But the important thing is that you get a lot more IOs out of it. So you get higher density. And one of the things that I've been noticing in the industry is that if you go back like 5 years ago, 3.5-inch drives were like on the order of, 5 to 6 times. The biggest 3.5-inch drive was 5 to 6 times larger than the biggest 2.5-inch drive. And gradually that differential has shrunk. So now the biggest 2.5-inch drive is 500 gigabytes. The biggest 3.5-inch drive, unless somebody's shipping a 2 gig that I haven't noticed, I think it's 1.5 gig is what's actually shipping now or getting ready to ship. So that delta has shrunk to, 2 to 3X from 5 to 6X about 5 or 6 years ago. And, of course, 2.5-inch drives, got better shock and vibe specs, and most of them are designed to power cycle much more than the 3.5-inch drives. So that's I think they are big in a small way. And the use model, and this first bullet, now, I keep learning stuff, and so, I'm perfectly willing to change my opinions if I learn something new. The floor space, not power, clearly they use more power per, cubic inch than 3.5-inch drives. On the other hand, they're much more space efficient. But then just a couple of weeks ago in Storage Mojo, I wrote a piece about Power Play, I think it was, if I can remember, and talking about some research that a Microsoft research guy had done. And Microsoft evidently has started charging people not for floor space in their computer room, but for power and on the basis of power. So kind of an interesting delta. And what they found was people got a lot more efficient when they were being charged for power instead of floor space. And, who would think that? Anyway, I think it's an opportunity to re-architect the array because fundamentally it does change for the better the relationship between the number of IOPS and the number of spindles that you can get out of a certain space. I think 2.5-inch drives, large capacity 2.5-inch drives with, very compact SSDs will enable us to build very high performance but physically small storage arrays.
Robin, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you think the only thing blocking it then is the large disk frame vendors moving their frames into that space? Because it was like 2.5 years ago, a Seagate guy asked me, hey, how can you help us get to 2.5-inch? And I said, I buy what the vendors have. I can't really tell them I want this and expect that they're going to give it to me.
Well, I think it's starting to happen. I mean, Seagate has been promoting their enterprise 2.5-inch drive, whatever that, I can't remember the name, but, and I'll go into this in the guaranteed uptime, but Atrato has come out with an array based on 2.5-inch drives, and it's really amazing. I mean, they've got, 80 spindles in there? I used to know, but then I wrote about it. But they've got a lot of spindles in, 2U or 3U, package. And of course, you know, in the bad old days, you know, EMC at one point there was, everybody else had migrated to 3.5-inch drives, but EMC was buying 90% of the 5.25-inch drives to put in SIMs back in the late 90s. And I don't know. I'm kind of hoping that, you know, EMC is going to, you know, maybe surprise us and be more of a leader this time. Because there's definitely advantages for customers in having, you know, more IOPS per cubic foot of, you know, array space. And but you're right. It's you know, people, you know, everybody knows 3.5-inch packaging, and this is a very conservative industry. So when is a vendor going to jump on this? I wish I knew. But I think Atrato, at least, is showing people what can be done. And I'm hoping that some of the other hungrier, smaller vendors will start moving in this direction and customers will see the benefit and start buying it. And that's how you put pressure on the big guys. You know, the big guys won't change unless they have to, because it's a big pain to, you know, new test fixtures and new packaging. You've got to qual it all. And, you know, it's a lot of engineering resource. It's just easier to use what you've got and keep sticking bigger SATA drives into it.
Don't you think there's also an economy of scale issue, though, too? I mean, there's not just that everybody's built a bunch of 3.5-inch enclosures, but the people that are doing it in a big way have a big investment in what they've got today. They could start genning up for new stuff, but anybody that starts out fresh has got all that investment to make.
Right, right. And this is where, you know, if you know, Xyrotex, you know, which builds a lot of the disk shelves that people use, I think NetApp and a number of large vendors and many, many, many small vendors use them. You know, if they start building, and they may have, 2.5-inch packaging, and generally, you know, they do a really high-quality job because they also build disk test equipment. So they're, you know, they're not just kind of regular metal benders. They actually have the expertise to really look at issues like, you know, rotational vibration and stuff like that and the impacts on the packaging. So if they start doing it, and it's a good idea, I should probably check, then that'll make it available to a lot of vendors. But you've got to get a Xyrotex, and I don't know what happened to Eurologic. Are they still selling packaging? Somebody bought them, and I forget who it was. But anyway, they had good packaging as well. So, but you're right. I mean, it's if I was even if I was NetApp, I wouldn't engineer my own 2.5-inch drive enclosures, because just the expense and stuff, and probably customers aren't going to see that big a benefit from it. You know, that you can, because remember, 2.5-inch disk drives cost more per gigabyte, and it's very hard to sell customers on buying IOPS instead of capacity, right? That was true 25 years ago, and it's still true today. Even though IOPS is what you need, you're only using 30% of your capacity. What does that tell you, Mr. Customer? How much is it per gigabyte? You know, that's it's pretty interesting. You know, the psychology of customers around that. But anyway. But I think, you know, the future of high-performance storage arrays really is with 2.5-inch drives, just because you can get so many more spindles and IOPS into a given physical container. More jelly beans in the box. So, and I'll talk a little bit more about that with Atrato and the guaranteed uptime thing. Enterprise flash SSDs. It's been wonderful watching the whole SSD thing develop. And of course, the marketing take is, you know, this is the miracle cure. Hey, it's based on quantum tunneling, you know, quantum. That's, you know, wonderful. And I think we're still on the rising part of the curve for the hype cycle for SSDs. But really, if you know anything about quantum physics, you know that quantum physics is pretty freaking weird. And so I think is the enterprise SSD market. The notebook SSD market is even weirder. And I've written a lot about that, especially on storage bits. But I don't think notebook SSDs are going to take off for a while. The basic question about, and this is slide 9, the basic, and I guess I didn't put numbers on the slide, sorry guys, this is the enterprise flash SSDs. The basic question about enterprise flash SSDs is, if we had shipped flash drive in 1957 instead of a disk drive, would flash drives today look like enterprise flash SSDs? And I think obviously, you know, the answer is no. We would be, our infrastructure would be vastly different if, you know, we wouldn't be trying to make flash look like disk drives today if we had, you know, been working with it for the last 50 years. Of course, the point that, you know, the Seagate and those guys will make, and it's a very valid one, is, hey, everybody uses disk drives. We all know how to use disk drives. We have, you know, standardized power and packaging, you know, all the connectors. You know, if we can make flash look like disk drives, then that makes, you know, makes for much faster uptake. And they're absolutely right. So it's a, you know, to me, it's a really interesting case of sort of you know, technology diffusion that we're dealing with here. So let's see here. The next slide, slide 10, the SSD problem. The reason that there's a problem with flash drives is that the flash, and there's a number of things, but the flash translation layer that translates, or the disk translation layer, depending on who you're talking to, is a really difficult problem because flash is really like not at all like a disk, you know, it's really basically an EEPROM, and so, you know, you're, every time you write to it, you're like programming it, and that's what the flash guys say. You don't write to a flash, you program a flash. And so there's a whole bunch of issues that people are having to deal with here, about, you know, engineering these translation layers. And, you know, like just one of the problems is, you know, the basic issue is that whenever you write a page, you have to write an entire block. And a page is typically 2K, a block is typically 128 or 256. And so, in order to, you know, for the drive to be ready to receive data, it's got to have empty blocks. And so, you know, you have this basically what is equivalent to a garbage collection algorithm in the background going around looking, you know, looking for blocks that, you know, that maybe aren't full or whatever, and you can... And then there's also the wear leveling that comes in there as well. So there's this fairly complicated algorithm in there so that you can have a steady supply of, you know, fresh blocks that you can write to when a write comes in. And, you know, there's a number of tunable parameters like any garbage collection algorithm, number of tunable parameters. And how you tune those affect, you know, the wear of, you know, because if you're real aggressive about it, then you're using a fair amount of bandwidth, which in a SSD tends to be scarce unless you've got an expensive one. And you're using a fair amount of compute cycles because you've got basically a microcontroller in there that's doing all this stuff. There's a lot of trade-offs. And nobody has figured all these things out yet. You know, I'm sure that some people are closer than others, but, you know, if you go back, you know, 15 years ago, different disk drives really had, you know, different 3.5-inch disk drives, really had different performance levels because, you know, some people figured out tricks before other people, and so their drives went faster. Now, you know, pretty much all 7,200 RPM drives are in the roughly the same performance band. And, you know, every 7200 RPM drive is, you know, pretty much reliably faster than every 5400 RPM drive. Didn't used to be that way. And it's that same thing here. There's a lot of IP secrecy right now in the industry. People aren't talking about what the trade-offs are. They're not talking about, you know, their solutions to these problems. So as a result, enterprise SSDs are, you know, they're really black boxes. And basically, and in slide 11, the flash problem is, if you look at that diagram of the SSD logic components, basically an SSD controller looks a lot like a RAID controller, but instead of controlling disks, you're controlling flash packages or chips. And you've got all these issues of bandwidth and your processor and buffer management, and, you know, and then you've got this interface thing that makes it look like a SATA drive or whatever. And this all comes about because we're creating this problem by making it look like a disk. It doesn't want to look like a disk. It's a lot closer to DRAM. But for those of you who remember storage arrays, the first baby storage arrays, which were pretty quirky and fragile and stuff, it took 6 or 7 years of real serious engineering in a high growth market to get storage arrays to the point where they were, you know, pretty reliable. And I think, you know, we're dealing with a lot of the same issues on flash SSDs. So kind of my take, and this is slide 12, is there's a lot of variety right now, a lot of variation in performance on flash SSDs. And there's some major potholes that, you know, that you wouldn't expect to see. And one of them that the guys at Microsoft Research found was that when you did two IOs that were separated by, you know, more than a 16 megabyte virtual address thing, the access times, the write times, were additive. And it's like, why would that be? Well, they weren't clear on why it would be, but evidently there was something going on in this translation layer. And that's not the kind of thing that anybody would even think to test for. You know, I mean, they're Microsoft engineers, and so they, you know, instrumented everything and were just looking at it, and they found it. But that's not the kind of thing your average end user would look to, would think to test for. So there's a lot of sorting out here. The complexity of this stuff is pretty amazing. I think also I'm hearing that the failure modes of flash chips are a little different than we expect. And partly that's due to the fact that to do a write in a flash cell, it's 20 volts. And 20 volts inside a chip, and, you know, where you've got insulators that are, you know, maybe a few molecules thick, you can have a problem with shorts. And what I have heard, I haven't seen any data on it yet, you know, formal data, is that flash chips, the failure rate is reasonably steady over time until, you know, maybe until you get to 90 or 120 days of use. And then, you know, they've got the reliability that we associate with most solid-state devices. And again, this is all hearsay. I haven't seen any data on it. But, you know, we all tend to believe that once you wave solder a bunch of chips onto a board and it passes the smoke test, that it's probably going to run for 50,000 hours. Evidently, not exactly the case with flash chips. So the kind of the take on those is, I think in the short term, and this is good news for Seagate and EMC and, you know, people that are investing in, disk-like flash, you know, SSDs, I think that's, you know, that's where the business is going to be for the next 3 to 5 years anyway, the majority of the business, because you have all these array vendors who can get an easy performance boost out of a flash SSD, putting it in their array. They've got the resources to really test them, to qualify them. They've got the economic clout to beat up their SSD vendor if the vendor doesn't, you know, produce what they said they were going to produce. And it just, you know, and they have complete control of the software environment, so they can take full advantage of, you know, whatever the flash disk can do, and they can, you know, they can say, okay, these kinds of writes are going to go to the flash, and, you know, these kinds of reads, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. They, you know, they've got a real opportunity to optimize for flash, and I think that's why we're going to see a lot of activity on flash SSDs inside arrays. I think it's a big win for these guys. But ultimately, go ahead.
This is Richard with another question. What you said about optimizing the writes for the flash drives, perhaps we haven't learned how to use them correctly. It's almost analogous to the reason that VTLs came into being is because we didn't know how to write to disk. We had to make it pretend to be tape. So now we're making memory pretend to be a drive. Maybe that translation layer is not a really good idea. It's just a way to get it out.
Right. That is totally my take on it. I'm in violent agreement with you, Richard. We're doing it this way because we know how to do it this way. Now, and this isn't, you know, part of the presentation, but, you know, another technology that I could have put in here and I thought about was what I call large memory servers. And, you know, some people have figured out how to put a hell of a lot of DRAM into your average server. You know, you fake the memory controller into thinking there's just, you know, 4 gigabytes, but there's really 64 gigabytes or, you know, and it's kind of virtualizing DRAM. Other people are looking at putting, you know, several gigabytes of flash and then, you know, 64 or 128 gigabytes or 4 gigabytes of DRAM and then like 64 gigabytes of flash and as kind of an extension to main memory. And other people, Fusion IO, somebody I'm doing some work for, they've got a little card that Barry White of IBM just wrote about. Apparently IBM has been working with that and they've gotten 1 million IOPS or something. The card is a PCI Express card. It looks like a disk, and they've got a fairly thin driver. But because it sits right on the PCI bus, you know, you get rid of all the latency associated with, you know, a host bus adapter and, you know, stuff like that. It looks to me like, you know, longer term, flash is going to make more sense in the industry as an extension or an enhancement or something. It's got to be a lot closer to the CPU because, you know, when you're dealing with disk drives and you've got millisecond latencies, the latency of, of an HBA and let's say a switch and then, you know, an array controller and finally you get to the disk, all that latency is, you know, lost in the is slop. But you look at it in terms of, well, gee, if you could have, you know, microsecond access time, then all of a sudden that latency becomes unacceptable, or it should be. So I think ultimately, you know, we're going to see flash. I mean, SSDs are going to be a big business and a good thing for the next, you know, 5 years and probably longer. But ultimately, we're going to, you know, the real win with flash is moving it closer to the CPU and DRAM. And something that people don't realize is DRAM uses a hell of a lot of power. because that's the dynamic part of it, right? We're refreshing it all the time. So replacing DRAM or extending DRAM with flash is also very, you know, power efficient. I think this whole massive memory server thing however that gets architected, there's going to be a lot of advantages to that, and people are going to go with that in a big way. Okay. That's the end of SSDs. If there are any questions about those, I'll take them right now. My God, I'm only two-thirds of the way through. Guaranteed uptime. Do you miss the TV repairman, your 3,000-mile tune-up? I think this is the basic issue that the guaranteed uptime guys are trying to address. I don't think they figured out how to communicate the advantages. And, you know, because in today's environment, most big companies, the CFO needs to sign off on major acquisitions. And you know, most people in the storage industry are woefully ill-equipped to market to CFOs. You know, I think this guaranteed uptime thing could be huge, because really, you know, people just want their storage to work, you know. And we've got two companies, neither one of which I have a relationship with, which, you know, be that as it may, that have come up with guaranteed uptime arrays. And I think this is an important potential for the data center. Now, why do I think that? You know, most engineers in the storage industry, I think of, you know, they think about the data center and they think, well, you know, it's a bunch of technical people. They're people like me. But having sold to both engineers and to data center people, they're not. They're totally different people. And I've written about this a few times on Storage Mojo. You know, IT is really a factory. They're in the business of shipping product, you know, every day. And if the product doesn't ship, they're in trouble and everybody knows about it. You know, the old example used to be payroll, but now it's, you know, if email is down or the web server's down or, you know, the OLTP storage goes down, everybody knows about it and it's painful and it's expensive. And so these guys, and manufacturing guys are, you know, there's something very powerful in manufacturing culture about being measured on your output every day. So these guys, they tend to be very, very clear on the fact that, you know, going with what works rather than what is potentially more elegant or potentially cheaper or, you know, whatever, going with what works is what these guys are all about. And engineers frequently don't seem to get that. And one of the big revolutions in manufacturing over the last, you know, 25 years, statistical process control, is all about measuring and minimizing variability. And I think that's where these guaranteed uptime arrays have the potential to be a real benefit that you could explain to a CFO, you know, that, you know, these arrays may cost a little bit more money up front, but they eliminate variability. You know, we are guaranteed that that amount of storage is going to be there, and it's going to be available, you know, 7x24. And we don't have to worry about disk drives failing and, you know, doing replacements and replacing the wrong drive and rebuilds happening during, you know, the last day of the quarter and, you know, all the stuff, all the variability that we have with our current you know, storage infrastructures. These really reduce that or have the potential to. And I think that's where the guaranteed uptime advantage really, you know, could be sold, you know, to people. But right now, of course, it's kind of like, you know, if you remember getting companies to embrace statistical process control and, you know, Six Sigma and, you know, all of that stuff, it was a real cultural change for a lot of manufacturing organizations. You know, it was the Japanese who embraced it first, and the success of Japanese products forced American manufacturers out of their lethargy, and they started going, gosh, I guess we got to do this stuff, and they started doing it, and lo and behold, you know, American automobiles are much more reliable than they were, you know, 25 years ago. They're more reliable than Japanese cars were 25 years ago. But, you know, people don't like change, and so I don't know exactly how this particular change is going to happen, but I see a lot of potential for it, and maybe it's going to be the kind of thing that cloud computing vendors use in order to improve their uptime, although they have serious problems, and I'll talk about those in a minute. But anyway, okay, slide 16, 10 gig E, very fast and still expensive. Will it kill Fibre Channel? You know, it's not coming down as in price as fast as I was expecting, but I think it will reshape storage networking. The obvious and too frequently made prediction is that 10 gig E will kill fiber channel. I don't believe that's the case. What will happen, I've been observing data centers for a long time. I mean, when I was selling to a Fortune 500 company, just before I got there, they took a 7-year lease on an IBM mainframe. Okay. Which was remarkable. Yes? Is a question? Okay. Oh my God. I've got 7 minutes here. Let's see. So anyway, 10 gig E isn't going to kill fiber channel, but it will mark the beginning of a long decline of fiber channel as we know it today. Fiber channel first came out, fast Ethernet was 100 megabytes per second, and fiber channel, it was gigabit, but it was substantially faster than fast Ethernet. And then, of course, fiber channel moved up to 2 gig and 4 gig, and now, the first 8 gig products have been coming out. And in the meantime, of course, gigabit Ethernet came out. But the net is that the performance advantage between Ethernet and fiber channel has been eroding. And that's the fundamental problem for fiber channel, because storage ultimately is, it's about performance and reducing latency and all that good stuff. However, the people who've bought fiber channel are going to continue to invest in it, and so it's not going to be going away anytime soon. The other thing is that, fiber channel traditionally is focused on kind of the high volume OLTP space. And what we're seeing is, and I'm just working on a post right now, what we're seeing is that more and more data is being written and, rarely if ever read. The kind of OLTP blinders that people have, which is, got to have his, the TCP benchmarks, we got to have a million IOPS a second and, blah, blah, blah. That's an increasingly smaller and smaller part of the marketplace, for storage. If you're going to write something and you're never going to read it again, or you're only going to read it once or twice, kind of what's the point of having ultra low latency kinds of things? You don't need InfiniBand for that. You don't need fiber channel for that. So I think Ethernet is definitely going to hurt fiber channel, but fiber channel is going to be around for years and years, maybe even decades. Just kind of like mainframes still are. People predicted the death of mainframes for decades now. The one thing that's really interesting, I think, is fiber channel over Ethernet, and with some of the protocol changes that they're doing for Ethernet to make it really low latency and whatever the buffer credit equivalent thing they're doing for it. I haven't looked at that protocol very closely, but I think you will have fiber channel, and fiber channel over Ethernet is what it's going to look like. But traditional fiber channel ultimately is dead, but fiber channel over Ethernet should be around for a long time. Cloud storage, number 18, slide 18. Cloud storage, boy, it was climbing the hype cycle really fast there, and then Amazon's been having the problems with S3, and I think people are like going, wait a minute, this isn't exactly what we had in mind. I think Amazon's going to be lucky to have, 99.9% uptime this year, maybe just 99% uptime this year, given all the problems they've had with S3. But I definitely believe there's a future for cloud storage. It's just not the kind of obvious one that people have been, you know, they look at S3 and they go, oh, you know, or they look at Nervonix, and hey, you know, that's the future of cloud storage. I'm not so sure it is. One of the reasons is, and this didn't make the presentation at SNEA, but my associate at Data Mobility Group, Joe Martins, has been doing some research on the economics of you know, cloud storage. And fundamentally, he hasn't had any luck finding, like, massive economies of scale in the cloud storage infrastructures that he's looked at. And that has, you know, some pretty major implications. You know, if it's not actually going to be cheaper, then you've got to look at, well, gee, then why are we, you know, spending network bandwidth and dealing with latency and, you know, stuff like that so that we can have, so that we can use cloud storage. And I think that's a, you know, that's, ultimately this stuff is all about the economics, right? I mean, it's not about technical elegance and purity of intention and things like that. Either it's faster, better, or cheaper, or, you know, it's an also-ran. And, I mean, clearly cloud storage isn't faster. And if it's not cheaper, I mean, it's better in some ways, you know, from a disaster tolerance kind of thing, it can be better. But if it's not cheaper, at least at the provider end, you got a problem. You know, it's people are going to be, wait a minute, why am I spending money on something when I could have it in my local data center, much lower latency, under my personal control? So anyway, that's kind of the issue that I see with cloud storage. However, I do believe that private clouds are going to be popular. And I think, you know, this is where EMC, it's another area where EMC is leading the industry because their Maui product is basically a cloud storage product that, you know, it could be sold to ISPs who would outsource it, you know, who would sell it to small and medium businesses, which is totally reasonable. But it can also be sold to, you know, global 100 enterprises who already have their own private networks and, you know, networks of data centers and stuff like that. These people can build their own private clouds using very low-cost storage. For them, it will look like a pretty good deal. Because you know they've already got they've already got all the overhead. Now they can just add, you know, a few hundred terabytes or a few petabytes of cloud storage, and you know take care of a number of problems as long as the management scales as well as the storage does. So,
yeah, when I heard the EMC guys come in and sort of initially talk to me about Maui, and at the time I was an outsourcer, and they couldn't really explain to me how exactly I was going to use it. The assumption was I'd have all the tools to figure it out. And I was like, boy, you guys are going to have a tough sell with that one. No, this is the Maui after the product release came out. It was sort of like, is it NAS?
Yeah, is it implemented via NAS?
Well, as it was explained to me, well, it can be anything you want. You just have to lay your tools on it. And it's like, that's an odd one for EMC.
Okay. Yeah, it is. And that's kind of what Sun is trying, you know, with its storage strategy, as best I can understand it. I haven't met anybody yet who can explain Sun's storage strategy to me, so I'm kind of guessing here. And Sun, you know, is kind of the, you know, has always been the vendor to the do-it-yourself crowd. I think and one of the reasons I think Maui has been delayed is that, you know, they've come to realize that, hey, you know, we need to fix some things here. And it needs to be a product. It can't just be a, you know, laboratory demo. So I've done quite a bit of research on that. And I'm very impressed that EMC is doing this. I think they've bitten off more than they knew. When they started on it, but You know, it's really, you know, 10 years ago, EMC, just as an aside, EMC was kind of the, you know, they were the bad guys who were holding the industry back. And, you know, if you were looking for real innovation, you weren't looking at EMC. But now, you know, I look around the industry and I have to say that, you know, with their cloud computing initiative and Paul Moritz and Pi Corp and Maui and, you know, all the various initiatives that they've got going, buying Mosey, they're, you know, they're really the guys who are, seem to be shaking up the industry the most right now. And you know, I have to give Tucci credit for that. And I think it's a smart thing to do because the industry is definitely headed for some big changes. The other issue about, cloud storage is it's not clear to me that the Amazon S3 model is really, you know, competitive with kind of a content distribution network model. Because really, I mean, if you're going to be selling this to smaller private companies, then, you know, smaller private companies probably don't need this, you know, global availability and some of the stuff that cloud storage theoretically can give you. And they would be much happier with a CDN type structure where the storage is distributed and closer to them physically, and there's, you know, fewer moving parts between them and the internet, on the internet, between them and their storage. And so, you know, ultimately it might be, you know, like the Akamai's that are able, if they choose to, are able to monetize kind of this cloud storage market because they've already got the CDN network. And it really comes down to the economics, and that's why this issue of are there economies of scale in storage, and where are they? That's the really, you know, critical piece. And I haven't done any calculations on it, but it's something I'm looking at, and I'm trying to get a handle on it. And it's not clear to me, you know, if there are economies of scale, but I suspect that they hit you kind of at the data center level. You know, that once you've built a data center and you've got it loaded with storage and, you know, some processors and stuff, you know, the next one isn't going to be any cheaper, you know. And so it's an interesting, to me, interesting problem as a analyst kind of guy. A little bit about Maui. You know, Maui appears to be a pretty sophisticated, geo-aware global cluster for cloud storage. And then the Pi Corp acquisition, at least theoretically, not in V1 of Maui, certainly, but, you know, at some point, Pi Corp was doing some pretty sexy stuff with metadata management and creation, you know, where you automate the creation of the metadata. And it's more advanced metadata than what we have today. So, you know, it looks at, gee, when you access, you know, this object, do you also have, you know, what other objects do you tend to access? And, you know, does kind of the stuff that we've been doing in storage for years, like prefetching and things like that. And, you know, enables you as the user to look at your data as a series of relationships rather than just, you know, creation dates and, you know, file names and stuff like that. That said, you know, EMC, what they're trying to do with Maui is just a very tough thing. And, you know, I wish them a lot of luck with it because I think it's going to shake up the industry in a major way. You know, probably not V1 so much, but, you know, the problems I think are solvable. And so I think it's going to be really big, you know, a really big thing. So this, the slide 20, cloud architecture, I do think global enterprises will want to buy, cloud storage, and they'll be able to optimize it for their particular business needs. And, you know, for some people, it's just going to be, hey, we need something to replace tape. You know, we get sued all the time. We have discovery all the time. We just need to have everything on disk so that we can, you know, when there's a lawsuit and we need to do discovery, we have a process and we just do it, you know, and we don't have to, you know, deal with finding tapes and trucks and, you know, all that stuff. And of course, there's a big move afoot to, you know, automate discovery as much as possible and to have non-lawyers do it. It's one of the dirty little secrets of the law business that, you know, law firms love it when they get these big discovery things because you get a room full of lawyers at least $175 an hour sitting around looking through paper. And they love it, you know, because it's like, okay, you know, and they're just, what are they doing? I mean, they're very expensive pattern recognition machines and very slow. And so there's a big move afoot to automate as much of this discovery stuff as possible. And you know, they're, like, one problem is that if it's a communication between, like, a CEO and a company lawyer, that's privileged. And so that doesn't go into the discovery bucket. And so you need some intelligence to look at it. But the whole data access part of it is, you know, if you can just access the data faster, for companies that get sued a lot, and there's a bunch of them out there, it just makes a lot more sense to have it all on disk rather than deal with tape. I think, SMEs are gonna go for cloud storage primarily for backup and disaster recovery kinds of uses. I don't think nobody's ever going to be running OLTP on cloud storage. And again, the issue of, you know, do CDNs make more sense than global clusters? That's an interesting problem.
What is a CDN?
Content Delivery Network.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, because clusters, CDNs are, you know, what we would sort of used to call distributed computing. And, clusters, global clusters are considerably more complex and have more overhead. And they also have some significant advantages. I just not sure that the advantages are going to be there for the SME market. I think they will be for the global market, the global 100 market, but not everybody else. So, okay, finally, we're at the conclusion, and boy, have I run on. Slide 21. Clearly, there's a lot of turmoil in data center architectures, and I think that's a wonderful thing. It makes being in this industry a lot more interesting. I think Google really set it off. You know, when people started realizing 5 years ago or 3 years ago that, you know, Google had built this giant storage infrastructure that was 7x24 and, you know, was, you know, handling huge amounts of data and delivering, you know, sub-second response times across the internet. And they realized they'd done it all with commodity components. You know, there was no EMC in there. There was no IBM in there. I think that was a wake-up call for a lot of people, you know, that, hey, there really is a different way to do this stuff. Now let's figure it out. And there's a lot of interesting competing technologies out there right now, too, different ways of doing these things. I think storage clusters, at least local storage clusters, are, you know, big and rapidly getting bigger. I think, you know, end users are getting an appreciation for the fact that their workloads aren't the way they were 10 years ago. And, of course, perceptions typically lag reality. And I think people are waking up to the fact that, hey, you know, a lot of our data, you know, we write it once. We may never read it again. But we need to be able to read it. You know, case of lawsuit or, you know, some critical issue comes up and we need that particular piece of data. We need to be able to access it. And so there's definitely a major market developing and sort of, write once, read occasionally, storage, you know, that's deliberately not terribly high performance. You know, it's high performance in terms of ingesting lots of data, but not so high performance in giving it back. You know, if you can get the data, and this is what, who is it? The guys at Copan, I guess. You know, if you can get your data in 10 seconds instead of 2 hours, that's a huge advantage over tape. And so I think people are waking up to the fact that their workloads are just fundamentally different than they used to think. So as a result, we got all these new architectures. We got all these competing technologies. Customers are getting smarter about what it is they really need. So I think the future of storage looks really great. I think we've got a very interesting decade ahead of us. The long-term product problem for storage is as soon as you store your data, it starts trying to evaporate. As we store more and more stuff electronically, digitally, there's just going to be greater and greater need for people who know how to make it work and keep the data from evaporating while it's in storage or eroding. So anyway, are there any questions? Is there anybody still on the call?
Oh, yeah, we're still here.
I have one that just an observation on the turmoil in data center architecture. My experience is that that's where a lot of IT people look to their later retirement years. So when I bump into facilities and whatnot, it tends to be someone who's not the least bit interested in evolving what we might be able to do, because, you know, I hear over and over again, well, we always do it like this.
Yeah.
And it's not like you get a, you know, brand new MBA or the best manager in the company saying, I'm going to go run the data center, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I bumped into this. I was at a conference in Las Vegas, I think in January, and this guy from Time Warner got up and was talking about how they had, you know, taken, 5,000 rack units of old storage and turned it into 2,000 rack units of new storage, and they tripled their capacity and, you know, blah, blah, blah. This is so wonderful. And afterwards I went up and I said, so it is pretty wonderful, but why didn't you go with file storage? Why were you using block storage? And he was like, well, my boss knows block storage, likes block storage. It's worked for him. He made his career on it. So we're buying block storage, you know. And I'm like, whoa. But it's a very conservative industry, and that's part of the fun of marketing to it, you know, is how do you make something that's radically new look very comfortably old and safe.
Yeah. Well, just even on simple things where you say, now explain to me why we have to move all that air. You know, wouldn't it be cheaper if, and it's like, well, no, we all, you know, this is what all data centers look like, you know. So it's hard to even get innovation into what might seem like a simple thing, mm-hmm. or simple to me, I guess.
Right, right. Well, the there's a group called the Uptime Institute. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but they're focused purely on data center facilities. They do some interesting research and stuff on power usage and stuff like that. And these guys are really, really, really conservative, you know. And that's, it comes back to that, you know, IT is a factory. And if you've ever dealt with manufacturing people are exactly the same way. You know, we've always done it this way, and boy, you're going to have a hard time convincing me to do it another way, you know, because at least the way we've been doing it works as well as it does. And you're telling me it can be better. I've heard that before, you know. It's
and it's not that we've never failed to deliver on a promise.
Yeah, right. But we just feel like we'd fail more often if we changed anything. You know?
Yeah, why does life keep feeling like a Dilbert cartoon?
Yeah. Yeah, Scott Adams is a genius.
You worked on my computer for 3 days, and now I can't do anything. Yes, but I did get the code upgrade in, so I'm just...
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, speaking of turmoil, isn't turmoil just a euphemism for a new market?
Absolutely. I mean, you know,
HP's spinning up a whole, you know, a whole division on this topic.
What division is that?
Well, I don't know. I get this off-brand. Actually, it's a paper magazine. It's a paper thing called Transforming Your Enterprise. It's a publication they push out.
Hmm.
And it's quite interesting. Technology for better business outcomes.
Wow.
And they are all over reinventing the data center. They bought a company, and you know the minions are going around the country looking for people to entice in.
Yeah,
it's a slick magazine.
Yeah, I've recently done some stuff for HP, and of course I was working at DEC. I was part of the original team that rolled out StorageWorks.
Cool.
And I was actually the product manager for the very first ever StorageWorks branded product.
EMA.
Oh no, this goes way back. This is 1992, probably, maybe 93. I think it was 92. And it was a real small team and, you know, a lot of esprit de corps, and we had a hell of a lot of fun with it. I actually have a pair of StorageWorks suspenders. Now, what the hell that had to do with market and storage? I guess it was the belt and suspenders thing. I don't know. And one of these days I'm going to give them away. I got to figure out I don't know if anybody would want to win a pair of StorageWorks suspenders, but, you know, maybe the HP Museum would like them or something. I don't know, the computer museum. But, yeah, they HP has been re-engineering their data centers, and they had some number. They went from like 60 data centers, and I assume some of those were like closets and stuff. And they're consolidating down to, I don't know, 4, some number like that. And the company they used to help them figure all this stuff out is the company they bought. And so I kind of like it. I mean, it's one of those, you know, eating your own dog food
right
kinds of things. And yet, I don't know how broadly applicable it really is. One of the reasons HP has 60 data centers was they bought Compaq, which had bought DEC, and Compaq had bought Tandem, and they bought these other companies, and then they spun out the instrument business. I mean, they've been through a lot of restructuring. And then they have, you know, like the printer division up in Idaho and all that stuff. I mean, they're kind of I don't know how common they are, you know, kind of worldwide, but, yeah, it's an interesting, the thing I find interesting about HP as a marketing company is that, you know, the old joke about HP is if they were marketing sashimi, they would call it cold dead fish. And, you know, because they really just are these, you know, this engineering mentality. And they have a hard time kind of finding the, you know, the fun and you know, the how to hook people with this stuff. I'm glad they've got a glossy magazine. I'd love to see a copy. They have their work cut out for them. But then on the other hand, I look at IBM. And, you know, I mean, for the first, you know, 40, 50 years of the industry, IBM, I mean, it's been the behemoth, you know, IBM and the Seven Dwarfs. And now, you know, HP is like opening a wider and wider gap in terms of revenue between themselves and IBM. I mean, IBM is really seems to be kind of off on their own, in their own world, and not, you know, not that being the biggest is necessarily the most important thing. Their stock price is certainly in a good place, but they kind of seem to have, I think they've lost their way, and I'm kind of wondering, you know, Lou Gerstner kind of got them out of the product business, but I think at some point they've got to get back into the product business because, I mean, this is about products. It's not strictly a service industry. You know, the people who build the products are always going to be a little more knowledgeable about them than the people who just service them. And so I think IBM has a challenge ahead of them. So.
Got to go. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your time, and I hope you found it useful or informative or something, you know, amusing. Let's call it. Pardon?
Disruptive.
Disruptive. There we go.
That's
there
right,
are things that did not get done because of this.
That's yes. You're not the only
one. I call that disruptive.
Absolutely. Well, thank you all very much.
Yes, and thank you very much, Robin, for joining us on the call. It's always a pleasure when you can come and spend as much time as you're able to give us, and I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And I appreciate the pleasure of having gotten to see it down in San Jose and then with your revised deck.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
All right.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.